degrees. And then through Wednesday night, heavy rain for all with some strong winds. Another day of sunshine and showers, Jim, for Thursday.
All right, Matt, thank you very much. Now we continue our new book of the week. The inspiration for Steve McQueen's Oscar-nominated film, Solomon Northup's memoir, 12 Years a Slave, is an unflinching account of slavery and racism in 1850s America. Born a free man, Solomon has been kidnapped and sold to a slave trader. Threatened with death should he ever reveal what happened, he fears he will never see his family again. The reader is Rashaan Stone.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
It was a dark night. All was quiet. I could see lights or the reflection of them, but there was no one, not even a straggler to be seen. So we passed, handcuffed and in silence through the streets of Washington, through the capital of a nation whose theory of government, we are told, rests on the foundation of man's inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Hail, Columbia, happy land indeed. Reaching the steamboat, we were quickly hustled into the hold. At Fredericksburg, we were transferred from the stagecoach to a car, and before dark arrived in Richmond, the chief city of Virginia. At this city, we were taken from the cars and driven through the street to a slave pen between the railroad depot and the river, kept by a Mr. Gooden. We were met at the door of Gooden's yard by that gentleman himself. Birch and he met with great cordiality. Gooden then turned to me.
"Well, boy, where'd you come from?"
Forgetting myself for a moment, I answered, "From New York."
"New York? Hell, what have you been doing up there?"
Observing Birch at this moment, looking at me with an angry expression that conveyed a meaning it was not difficult to understand, I immediately said, "Oh, I have only been up that way a piece." Gooden then turned to Eliza and her children, Emily and Randall, examining them severally and asking various questions. He was pleased with Emily, as was everyone who saw the child's sweet countenance. Presently, Birch came into the yard, unfettered me, and led me into one of the small houses.
"You told that man you came from New York," he said.
I replied, "I told him I had been up as far as New York, to be sure, but did not tell him I belonged there, nor that I was a free man. I meant no harm at all, Master Birch. I would not have said it had I thought." He looked at me a moment, as if he was ready to devour me. "If ever I hear you say a word about New York or about your freedom, I will be the death of you. I will kill you. You may rely on that." I doubt not he understood then, better than I did, the danger and the penalty of selling a free man into slavery. He felt the necessity of closing my mouth against the crime he knew he was committing. Of course, my life would not have weighed a feather in any emergency requiring such a sacrifice. Undoubtedly, he meant precisely what he said. In the afternoon, we were driven by Birch and Gooden from the yard through the streets of Richmond to the brig Orleans. She was a vessel of respectable size, fully rigged and freighted principally with tobacco. After we were all on board, the brig proceeded down James River. Passing into Chesapeake Bay, the handcuffs were taken off, and during the day we were allowed to remain on deck. Nothing to vary the monotony of our daily life occurred until we reached New Orleans. Very soon, traders and consignees came on board. One, a tall, thin-faced man with light complexion and a little bent, made his appearance, with a paper in his hand. Birch's gang, consisting of myself, Eliza, and her children, and some others who had joined us at Richmond, were consigned to him. This gentleman was Mr. Theophilus Freeman. Reading from his paper, he called, "Platt." No one answered. The name was called again and again, but still there was no reply.
"Captain, where's Platt?" he demanded.
The captain was unable to inform him, no one being on board answering to that name.
"Who shipped that nigger?"
he again inquired of the captain, pointing at me.
"Birch," replied the captain. "Your name is Platt. You answer my description, why don't you come forward?"
he demanded of me in an angry tone. I informed him that was not my name, that I had never been called by it, but that I had no objection to it as I knew of.
"Well, I will learn you your name," said he, "and so you won't forget it either."
From the vessel, I observed the chain gang at work on the levee. We passed near him as we were driven to Freeman's slave pen. Could it be possible that I was thousands of miles from home, that I had been driven through the streets like a dumb beast, that I had been chained and beaten without mercy, that I was even then herded with a drove of slaves, a slave myself? Were the events of the last few weeks realities indeed? Or was I passing only through the dismal phases of a long, protracted dream? It was no illusion. Mr. Theophilus Freeman bustled about in a very industrious manner, getting his property ready for the salesroom, intending, no doubt, to do that day a rousing business. We were conducted into a large room in the front part of the building to which the yard was attached, in order to be properly trained before the admission of customers. The men were arranged on one side of the room, the women on the other. Freeman charged us to remember our places, exhorted us to appear smart and lively. Many customers called to examine Freeman's new lot. A planter of Baton Rouge purchased Randall. All the time the trade was going on, his mother was crying aloud and wringing her hands. She besought the man not to buy him unless he also bought herself and Emily. She promised, in that case, to be the most faithful slave that ever lived. The man answered that he could not afford it. And then Eliza burst into a paroxysm of grief, weeping plaintively. Freeman turned round to her savagely, with his whip in his uplifted hand, ordering her to stop her noise or he would flog her. The bargain was agreed upon, and Randall must go alone. Then Eliza ran to him, embraced him passionately, kissed him again and again, told him to remember her, all the while her tears falling in the boy's face like rain. The planter from Baton Rouge, with his new purchases, was ready to depart.
"Don't cry, Mama. I'll be a good boy. Don't cry," said Randall, looking back as they passed out of the door.
What has become of the lad? God knows. Next day, we were again ordered to the salesroom for the inspection and examination of purchases. A gentleman was waiting for us as we entered. He offered Freeman $1,000 for me, $900 for Harry, and $700 for Eliza. As soon as Eliza heard it, she was in agony again. Never have I seen such an exhibition of intense, unmeasured, and unbounded grief as when Eliza was parted from her daughter. She broke from her place in the line of women, and rushing down where Emily was standing, caught her in her arms. The child, sensible of some impending danger, instinctively fastened her hands around her mother's neck and nestled her little head upon her bosom. Freeman sternly ordered Eliza to be quiet, but she did not heed him. He caught her by the arm and pulled her rudely, but she only clung the closer to the child. Then, with a volley of great oaths, he struck her such a heartless blow that she staggered backward and was like to fall. Oh, how piteously then did she beseech and beg and pray that they might not be separated.
"Mercy, mercy, master," she cried, falling on her knees. "Please, master, buy Emily. I can never work any if she is taken from me.
I will die. Freeman interfered again, but disregarding him, she still did plead most earnestly, telling how Randall had been taken from her, how she never would see him again, and now it was too bad. Oh God, it was too bad, too cruel, to take her away from Emily. Her pride, her only darling, that could not live, it was so young, without its mother. Finally, after much more supplication, the purchaser of Eliza stepped forward, evidently affected, and said to Freeman he would buy Emily, and asked him what her price was.
What is her price?
Buy her? Was the response of Theophilus Freeman. And instantly answering his own inquiry, he added,
I won't sell her. She's not for sale.
The man remarked he was not in need of one so young, that it would be of no profit to him. But since the mother was so fond of her, rather than see them separated, he would pay a reasonable price. But to this humane proposal, Freeman was entirely deaf. He would not sell her then on any account whatever. There were heaps and piles of money to be made of her, he said, when she was a few years older. There were men enough in New Orleans who would give $5,000 for such an extra, handsome, fancy piece as Emily would be, rather than not get her. No, he would not sell her then. She was a beauty, a picture, a doll, one of the regular bloods, none of your bullet-headed cotton-picking niggers. If she was, might he be damned. When Eliza heard Freeman's determination not to part with Emily, she became absolutely frantic. I will not go without her. They shall not take her from me, she fairly shrieked, her shrieks commingling with the loud and angry voice of Freeman, commanding her to be silent. Meantime, we were at the front door, ready to leave. Our purchaser stood near us, gazing at Eliza with an expression indicative of regret at having bought her at the expense of so much sorrow. We waited some time, when finally, Freeman, out of patience, tore Emily from her mother by main force, the two clinging to each other with all their might. Don't leave me, Mama, screamed the child, as its mother was pushed harshly forward. Don't leave me. Come back, Mama, she still cried, stretching forth her little arms imploringly. But she cried in vain. Out of the door and into the street we were quickly hurried. Still we could hear her calling to her mother. Come back. Don't leave me. Come back, Mama. Until her infant voice grew faint, and still more faint, and gradually died away as distance intervened, and finally was wholly lost. Eliza never after saw or heard of Emily or Randall. Day nor night, however, were they ever absent from her memory. In the cotton field, in the cabin, always and everywhere she was talking of them, often to them, as if they were actually present. Only when absorbed in that illusion, or asleep, did she ever have a moment's comfort afterwards. Now she weepeth sore in the night, and tears are on her cheeks.
Roshan Stone was reading 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. The book is abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Thank you. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Wednesday, the 26th of February. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Cromarty, Biscay, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Bailey 974, expected Southeast Iceland 989 by 1800 Wednesday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours: Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira. Southerly or southeasterly 6 to gale 8, rain or showers, moderate or good. 40s, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Southerly or southwesterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 for a time in Cromarty. Showers, good.